This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have another update from attorney Jeff Haas on the protest encampment at Standing Rock.
It's quite amazing what's going on there, and we've got some legal victories under our belt.
We'll speak with screenwriter Zachary Sklar about Oliver Stone's new film, Snowden.
This is a riveting film, which we encourage everybody to see. And if you read a bad review, be suspicious of its author.
New York attorney Jonathan Stribling Us tells us why more attorneys should be encrypting all of their communications.
I remember the day that Michael Ratner bought an expensive gadget to do this. Now you can get it for free. Listen how.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
National Security Director James Clapper was being questioned by Congress. The news media was there. He looked the camera right in the eye. The question was, does the NSA spy on Americans? He answered, not wittingly. This was a lie. The NSA was spying on every computer keystroke and telephone call made by every American. Edward Snowden blew the whistle on this totalitarian practice that turned democracy upside down. Instead of the government serving the people, the government was spying on the people it should be serving. Snowden has been indicted under the 1917 Espionage Act. He's presently living in Russia, stripped of his passport, unable to travel, unable to come home, where he faces decades in prison, or worse. Oscar-winning film director Oliver Stone's just-released movie Snowden tells Edward Snowden's story. We are joined today by film writer Zachary Sklar, who, with Oliver Stone, wrote the film script to Stone's Oscar-winning movie JFK, which tells the story of the CIA assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Zachary Sklar is a screenwriter, journalist, author, and editor. Sklar has edited numerous nonfiction books about U.S. intelligence, including the number one bestselling On the Trail of the Assassins by Jim Garrison, from which the film JFK was adapted. Prophets of War, Inside the Secret U.S.-Israeli Arms Network by former Israeli intelligence operative Ari Ben-Menashe, and Deadly Deceits, My 25 Years in the CIA by former CIA case officer Ralph McGeehee.
Zach, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Now, those of us in the studio have all seen the film Snowden when it came out this weekend. Can you tell us what the film is about and why is it important?
The film is the human side of the story of Edward Snowden, who worked for the CIA and the NSA and revealed thousands of previously secret documents that showed massive surveillance that the NSA was engaged in. Of course, this received a lot of news coverage in daily newspapers and in the excellent Academy Award-winning documentary Citizen 4. But what this film that Oliver Stone has made does that's different is that it shows the human being behind the news stories. It shows the evolution of his consciousness from someone who was a true believer, a patriot in the narrowest sense of America, right or wrong, to someone who started to see what the United States intelligence agencies were actually engaged in. And because he was a very intelligent guy, started to put two and two together and realize what he was participating in. It took a long time, but his consciousness evolved, and eventually he could not live with the secrecy that he'd been under, and he revealed these documents, not directly, but to the press, thinking that the journalists could decide what was newsworthy and what was not. He didn't think that was his decision, but he thought that in a democracy, an informed public was essential. So what this film does is it goes beyond the headlines, and it goes beyond all the character assassination that the government and the media engaged in initially when Snowden made these revelations. They called him a traitor and liar and so forth.
Zachary Sklar, can you give us some sense of the evolution of Ed Snowden's thinking? He started out after 9/11, joining the special forces, and then he ended up doing what he did. How did he go from being kind of a naive, idealistic person to doing what many people regard as an extraordinary act of patriotism and decency?
Well, like many whistleblowers, Snowden began as a young idealist, and I would say a fairly naive one, believing in all the cliches of American democracy, liberty, freedom, and justice for all, and all that stuff, and was willing to put his life on the line for that. He joined the Army Special Forces, but he could not continue with that because his legs were broken, and they basically said he could not do it physically. So he joined. He was a computer genius, self-taught, and he joined the CIA. They recognized pretty quickly that this man had great talent that they could use, and he joined the CIA and started working on these programs, secret programs, with some of which he helped design. He also wanted to get involved with special ops, black ops, you know, more in the field kind of stuff. And the film shows him getting involved in some of the stuff that the CIA actually engages in, but he found that he couldn't stomach it because they were doing things like setting up, you know, there's a banker from Pakistan that they set up because they want to blackmail him, and they get him drunk and they almost kill him, and they blackmail him about his daughter and so forth. This kind of stuff he really couldn't stomach. He was a young idealistic guy, and he really didn't understand at that point the human consequences of what the CIA was up to. He then went back to Washington, and through his relationship with his girlfriend, who was much more skeptical about these things, he started to realize that the domestic surveillance was pervasive, including spying on him and his girlfriend. There's a particularly vivid scene where he realizes that through her webcam that the NSA can actually monitor what's going on in their own home. So he starts to see these things, and then he's tapped to go to Hawaii and work on cyber counterintelligence operations against China and design programs, and he realizes that he sees what the NSA is up to, including the live surveillance through telephones of people suspected of being terrorists. And then through drones, these people are blown up. He witnesses all this so that he starts to see that there are terrible human consequences to what is going on. He knows that just because a telephone is tracked, it doesn't mean that the person that being tracked is a terrorist, that in fact they can't identify who that is, or that there will not be what they call collateral damage, meaning innocent civilians killed by drones. So all these things start to add up, and he starts to realize that his own domestic life is being watched, and he finally reaches a point where he also realizes that this is worldwide. It's not just the U.S. They're not just surveilling people who are suspected terrorists. They're actually surveilling everyone. Everyone in the entire world is under their surveillance. They're monitoring phones. They're monitoring the Internet. They basically know, and when I say they, I'm talking about the NSA and the CIA, that they are watching everything and recording everything that basically everyone is doing. They know, you know, where you've been. They know who you've talked to. They know what your banking situation is. They know what you've bought, you know, what movies you've seen, what you've watched on television, what you've done on the Internet. All these things are recorded. So he started to realize the implications of this, and at a point he just broke. He couldn't take it anymore, and he felt that these things were way beyond anything that he considered to be a democratic society, and he felt that the people should know about it. So that's what happened, and he revealed the documents, not directly, but through journalists that he trusted, Laura Poitras, Glenn Greenwald, and Ewan McCaskill of The Guardian, and also The Washington Post and The New York Times, and they ended up printing those things, you know, some of which were very, very damning, including, you know, that the NSA was monitoring the phones and emails of the presidents of Mexico and Brazil, of German Chancellor Merkel, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it became a huge scandal. Of course, he was immediately labeled a traitor by the government. And that's a way of covering up and also trying to discredit and do character assassination, which is a familiar pattern for any whistleblower has to go through that.
Zach, we want to talk about that, but first I want to say that it's been 25 years since you co-wrote JFK with Oliver Stone. What has changed during this time? And is the film Snowden a departure, or is it a continuation of Stone's earlier work?
Well, I think the main theme of the film JFK, the thing that struck a raw nerve with people, was not the details of the Kennedy assassination, but the underlying theme was that there was a secret, invisible government that was unaccountable to the people, paid for by us, but totally unaccountable. That has only gotten worse in the 25 years since that movie was released. I think people were horrified by that. It was like, The Wizard of Oz, when the little dog pulls the curtain back, and for many people that was the moment when they realized that there was this unaccountable secret government going on that was running things, and there was no way to stop them, and people were horrified by that. But I think that what's happened since then is it's gotten much worse. I mean, the technology has exploded. And, you know, in the old days, the FBI wanted to monitor people. They're out there with agents, and they tap phones, and they actually watch people. They go outside. I mean, when I was a kid, my parents were surveilled, and they were actually physically sitting outside in a car watching who came to my birthday parties. Then they would compile all these, cards and documents, to create a file on people. Well, that's child's play compared to what's going on now. I mean, now they basically have the technology to know everything that everyone is doing in the entire world. So the secrecy has only increased, and that's what I think got the government so upset about Snowden's revelations, was that he broke that veil of secrecy. I think that has been Oliver Stone's main concern. I think that he is that his work has gone back and forth over the years, but I think that his main theme has been to reveal the secrecy of government and to try to make it more accountable. So I think this film is one of his strongest films. I think it goes back to his earlier work, and he, in a sense, is like Snowden. You know, Oliver was a true believer also. He was a Goldwater Republican when he was a teenager, and he dropped out of Yale to go volunteer to fight in Vietnam. He believed in all that, and it was only through his experiences, just like Snowden, that his consciousness changed. And though he was never in a position like Snowden to know exactly what the secret government was doing, he certainly could see what was going on in Vietnam, and he did his share of revealing the truth through his films. I think that this is just a continuation of that from his earlier work.
It's a stunning film, the film Snowden. Absolutely riveting. And we urge our listeners to go see it. And Zach, you worked closely with Oliver Stone when you wrote the film script to the movie JFK. And of course, that movie stands up to this day as being a very insightful movie about the power of the CIA, and would lead people to conclude, as I did then and still do believe, that it was the CIA that assassinated John Kennedy. Now, the hero of the movie JFK was Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney who prosecuted one of the people who were involved in the conspiracy. And Garrison tells that story. And it struck me that Garrison, I thought, had a lot in common with Snowden. And I wanted to ask you about what parallels you could draw.
Yes, I think there are parallels. And I think there are parallels with many whistleblowers. I've worked with several in the past, not just Garrison, but also Ralph McGehee, who worked for 25 years in the CIA and then wrote a book about those his experiences. Ari Ben-Menashe, who worked, you know, with the CIA as an Israeli undercover agent. These are all whistleblowers, and they have one thing in common. That first of all, they're very intelligent, all of them. They all began as idealists, and I think a little bit naive, believing in all the cliches of what America stood for, and Israel at that time for Ari Ben-Menashe in his case. With Garrison, it was clear that, and none of these people, I mean, Snowden, Garrison, they are not flaming radicals by any means. If anything, they're quite conservative and believe in the traditional values of America and so forth. But all of them are extremely courageous. They're all willing to volunteer and put their life on the line for their country. And all of them are changed by their experience. They are smart enough to see what's going on, and they change their consciousness as a result of that, and it leads to a sense of outrage that they're and betrayal. And then they are also, both Snowden and Garrison and these others as well, are strong enough and courageous enough to stand up and speak the truth, regardless of the personal consequences. I think there's a deep morality in all of them, which, you know, it seems old-fashioned almost in the society we live in now. They want to do what's right, and they are willing to take the consequences, whatever they may be, for their personal situation.
Zach, the qualities you've just described to me also sum up what it means to be a patriot. And there's a debate going on right now with the ACLU calling for President Obama to pardon Snowden. We've always felt he was a hero. What do you think the general public, the more they learn about Ed Snowden, do you think many will come to view him as a true patriot?
Yes, I think what happens with all these whistleblowers is that initially there's an onslaught of media and government criticism of them, that character assassination is what I would call it, and it is an orchestrated campaign. We know this from Jim Garrison's experience, because we got the CIA memo that actually outlined how they were going to use the media assets to slander him, to say that he was a gothic Southern politician, that he was a liar, that he messed with evidence. You know, there were all kinds of accusations made against him that were all outlined in this memo. So we know that it was an orchestrated campaign to use the assets that the CIA had in the media to plant articles about him that with these accusations. So I have no doubt that that is continuing as a program, and that every time there is a whistleblower, that's exactly what happens, and they get called a traitor, and it's a distraction to keep people from realizing what it is that these whistleblowers have revealed. I had, initially conversations with very intelligent colleagues who immediately said to me, "Oh, Snowden is a traitor. He should never have gone to Russia. He should have stayed and gone on trial if he wanted to stand up for his convictions," and so forth. I think as time has gone on, and we've seen much more come out, and there's been much more considered opinion about what he did, and this movie Citizen 4 helped enormously, and I think this film Snowden will also help enormously, that people start to understand. They see that this is not done as an act of spying or trying to give secrets to some other country. This is done as an act of what he considered to be patriotism, to reveal to the public the truth about what our country, our government was doing. And I think as that happens, people start to realize that it's not what they were initially told through this character assassination. And I think that the support for him is growing. You have a number of very important people, including Bernie Sanders, Daniel Ellsberg, and so forth, who have come out and are supporting the ACLU and the Amnesty International's campaign to bring Snowden home and have the charges against him dismissed, that he should be considered a hero, not prosecuted.
The problem is the Espionage Act, this 1917 law, and went after people who opposed World War One. The most prominent person to be imprisoned was, of course, Eugene Debs. But the Espionage Act is still on the books. They've charged him with it. And the Espionage Act doesn't make any distinction between people who steal secrets and then sell them for money, like Aldrich Ames or Robert Hansen. It doesn't make a distinction between that and a distinction between people who have the democratically inspired motives of Ed Snowden, so that he's been accused of treason. Even the Washington Post, which printed some of the stuff he revealed, now wants him to go to prison. Trump wants him executed. Hillary wants him to come back and face the music, she says. And my own opinion is that Obama doesn't have the courage or probably even the conviction to pardon him, which he could do, and that Snowden is in a lot of trouble, so that I think that this movie was a tremendous contribution to consciousness raising and to building the movement to do the right thing and not put him in prison for life.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I mean, immediately the intelligence establishment closes its ranks and insists that anyone who has defied it be prosecuted strongly as the government can, and that's why they charge him with the Espionage Act, even though he's not made a cent from any of this, including from the movie, and he's not given any secrets to foreign powers. The only secrets he gave to the Guardian and the Washington Post, the New York Times, and Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald. You know, they were the ones who made the decisions to release the information. I mean, the Washington Post is now calling for him to be prosecuted. They want a Pulitzer Prize for the very revelations that that Snowden gave them, and they printed. Snowden didn't decide to print those. The Washington Post did. And if they are calling for his prosecution, they should be calling for their own prosecution. Of course, I don't believe that either should be prosecuted. I think both have done a tremendous service by letting the American people know what their government is up to. But you're right. I mean, it's very hard for a sitting president to defy the intelligence establishment and the defense establishment. And I think we've seen that with Obama. We've seen it with every president before him. I mean, and that's why, you see Hillary Clinton and Trump and all these people still calling for him to be prosecuted under the Espionage Act, when, of course, he hasn't engaged in any espionage at all. And that distinction that you pointed out is very important. He has not been spying for any foreign power. He has just revealed important secrets that our government should not be keeping secret at all. And he's in a long tradition of whistleblowers that includes Daniel Ellsberg and others that have been very important to keeping what vestiges of democracy we have alive.
My fear is that the military, industrial, and now surveillance complex is so strong that they're going to do everything they can to get Snowden back here and put him in prison. And my question to you, Zachary Sklar, is what can our listeners do to help with the Pardon Snowden campaign?
Well, I think you're right. They will do everything they can to try to get him back here. And Snowden himself has said that he is certainly willing to stand trial for the acts that he committed, but on the condition that it be an open and public trial. That's the rub, because that's the last thing that the government would like to have happen, because in an open and public trial, there would be far more revelations of all the stuff that they're up to, which much of which is illegal. So that like what they did with Chelsea Manning, that was, of course, a military tribunal, but that trial was conducted totally in secret, and there was no way for the public to know what actually happened. So I think that Snowden obviously was aware of what had happened to Chelsea Manning and realized that if he came back and faced trial, it would be a kangaroo court, and it would be in secret, because they would say that national security issues were involved, and nothing that he wanted the public to know about would be revealed. So the question, how do we get him back here and either have the charges dropped or have a public trial. I think, you know, there is a campaign by the ACLU, led by the ACLU and I believe Amnesty International, that is petitioning to support Snowden and bring him home and have the charges dropped. I think that listeners should definitely go online and sign those petitions. The more people, the more public support he has, the more likely that he can actually get some justice in this situation. But it's an uphill battle, and I think the government does not give in on these things unless forced to. So I think, you know, one step also is to get people to see this film. You know, there are a lot of people who just don't pay much attention, who sort of see a headline, they hear that Snowden is a traitor, and that's all they know. And I think it's a big service that this film has done in that it humanizes and it shows exactly where this guy was coming from and what he did. And I think when people see this, they will rally to his support. So talk to people, get them to see the film, start discussions, and sign the petition to bring him home.
And we'll have a link to that petition on lawanddisorder.org. But Zach, we want to thank you so much for your time, your insights, and everything that you've done to help in related efforts.
Thank you for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
With winter settling in North Dakota, the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline has been temporarily halted pending governmental reconsideration. Representatives of over 100 Native American tribes and several thousand supporters are camped near the Missouri River in North Dakota, which the pipeline, if it breaks or leaks after its construction under the river, would pollute and ruin drinking water for up to 20 million people who depend on it. The Dakota Area Pipeline Company and its parent Texas Company have secured some $3.5 billion in financing from Goldman Sachs, UBS, Chase Manhattan Bank, and other banks, and they're paying interest on this money. More financing may not be forthcoming if the project is stalled too long. In the meantime, camp protesters, who call themselves water protectors, are preparing to stay through the upcoming, predictably severe North Dakota winter. We speak again today with New Mexico National Lawyers Guild environmental attorney Jeff Haas. He has been living at the encampment along with Bruce Ellison and has been leading the legal team. Jeff Haas, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We're getting used to your weekly updates. Can you let us know what's happened in the last week on the legal status of the pipeline construction?
Well, we had expected to appear actually yesterday because the pipeline had an injunction against anyone interfering with its construction up here in North Dakota. But a number of us, the ACLU and the tribal chairman and some Gill lawyers, we filed a motion to dissolve the injunction. And somewhat to our surprise, on Thursday, the 13th, he actually dissolved the injunction and said that so much was going on, and he actually didn't think he was going to be able to stop it. He called the people hooligans and outsiders and so forth, but a number of people had locked down on equipment, and I think he realized that bringing them into federal court and on a TRO was really not going to stop them and would probably provide another forum. But he basically ruled as, well, I can't enjoin illegal activity. So at least that restraint that was issued up here in North Dakota is lifted, and he basically said, I'm going to leave it to the criminal prosecutions. Meanwhile, in the D.C. case, even though the effort by the tribe to remove the permit of the pipeline was denied at the lower court, the higher court granted a stay on the area 20 miles east and west of Lake Oahe until the appellate court could rule. And that's been the area of most confrontation, where several incidents took place, including the ones with the dogs. Nevertheless, it appears that the pipeline company here on the west side of the Missouri, which is where we are, where the Standing Rock camp is, if not laying the pipe, they are in fact bringing the pipe to the area where to the path, and whether it's construction or pre-construction is hard to say. A number of people from the camp have gone out and actually locked themselves down to some of this equipment, and they have upped the charges from misdemeanor criminal damage to a reckless endangerment now. So we have 5 felony cases up here. And actually, it's not endangerment because there's very clear methods of locking yourself down, and they even explain to law enforcement how to get them undone without harming either them, the equipment, or law enforcement. So it's very disciplined, but it's portrayed as hooligans or random or so forth. But it's nonviolent, direct action aimed at stopping the building of this pipeline through tribal lands and treaty lands and land where there are a lot of sacred sites.
Attorney Jeff Haas, describe, please, for us what it's like being at the camp.
Well, the camp is a constant source of sort of energy and excitement. For example, yesterday we went to court. There have been 69 arrests here. And so one woman is still in custody because of a warrant actually somewhere else for protesting. So about 300 people came to the city of Mandan, an hour away, with drummers, with chanters, with singers, just to make noise outside the jail and to encourage to tell this woman that she still had a lot of support. And it was a beautiful ceremony with drums and traditional Sioux songs, and there a lot of people were led by AIM leaders going back to Wounded Knee. So that was just one event. Another event, when we got back to the camp yesterday, lo and behold, a march is coming up to the front with a big free Leonard Peltier sign. So the spirit for around Leonard, and he wrote a message to the camp last week, you know, is still very strong. And the camp thins out a little bit during the week and gets bigger on the weekend, but there's still people coming in all the time.
What kind of support do the water protectors have?
Well, we've got, right now, there are 5 lawyers here. Bruce Ellison and myself have been sort of back and forth, and there's 3 or 4 other lawyers here. The Lawyers Guild has put out a call, and we've been getting lawyers, and we're looking particularly for experienced criminal defense lawyers now to come up and take cases. So we're getting people out on bond. There's been a very big support, legal support, so that there has been bond money, and so everyone that could bond out has been able to. And now they've got cases set all the way up through till January. So we're looking for both local lawyers to join on with us, because the law in North Dakota is you have to work with a local lawyer. Even if you're pro hoc vice, you have to have a local lawyer on each case. Or even if you get admitted from out of state, there's like a 6-month wait. So we need to develop. We've got a couple of local lawyers who are stepping up, and we want to have more, and we want to have more experienced criminal defense lawyers come and commit themselves to taking a case or two.
And what's the legal situation with Amy Goodman and Jill Stein, who both visited the encampment?
Well, I believe I actually got a call from Jill Stein's lawyer yesterday and put her in touch with a local defense lawyer. I believe there are local warrants out for each of them for Class B misdemeanors for trespass, and perhaps for Jill for criminal damage to property. So they're making arrangements, and I guess, and I'm not quite sure whether they're going to come here or try to get the warrant lifted until they can come here, but there are active warrants for both of them.
Yeah, Jill wrote, "This message approved by Jill Stein on the blade of a bulldozer." So that's why they went after her.
The bulldozers had been tagged with no Dakota Access pipeline and keep it in the ground, and water is life, and she came and added her, "I approve this message," to what was already on the equipment. I did this in front of a camera. So that's the basis of her warrant. And, of course, Amy Goodman was in the place where she captured the security guard's dogs actually biting people. I remember her dialogue, that dog has blood on its mouth, and one of the women trainers was like pushing the dog or urging it to bite people and be aggressive. And about 9 people were bitten.
You know, many people think that because the trampling on Native American rights was so gross in this situation that it embarrassed the U.S. government, but that as the publicity subsides, people are afraid that the Dakota Access Pipeline Company is going to restart the project. What's the talk about this in the camp?
Well, I think people are realistic. I think we did get the response of the government when they came in immediately and said, we're withdrawing the permit, at least for the area under the lake and the Missouri River, which adjoins it, which means until that permit is granted, the pipeline can't be completed. And how long that review process is going to take is really questionable. It could be a month or 2 months, or it could go on for up to a year, depending on how thorough it is on its environmental impact and the likelihood that there could be leaks into the Missouri River. But the pipeline hasn't really stopped. It's unclear whether it stopped directly in the area and joined by the D.C. court. And then we noticed that there's new pipe appearing along the pathway. So they're prepared to go on. And in other areas, this pipeline goes all the way from North Dakota down the Midwest, down along the Missouri, into Illinois. And I heard that there were quite a few arrests in Iowa yesterday or the day before. So, and then organizing even in Illinois. So I think the pipeline is pretty committed, both because they've borrowed a good part of their $3.8 billion and they're paying interest on it, to continue this, and also their potential profit. If this pipeline were completed, it would be 500,000 gallons a day of high carbon oil coming from the Bakken oil fields, maybe eventually to even to the Gulf or at least to the Midwest. It's about the equivalent of adding 20 million cars, the oil that would just come from this pipeline.
It would be a huge environmental disaster, even if the pipe doesn't break.
It is. There's no question in terms of the carbon pollution that would result. There's no doubt about it. And, of course, it also goes through various sacred sites, which the most fundamental rights of Native Americans internationally is the right to be consulted on projects that threaten their sacred sites and that threaten their environment. And here, just the most superficial study was done. So it's very important for that purpose, and also for the likelihood that there could be leaks into many tributaries, including the Missouri River.
The tribe did what Malcolm X always urged people to do, and that is it's a violation of human rights. And the tribal chief actually appeared, I think it was yesterday, in Geneva in front of a United
Right.
Nations committee. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, well, I think there are various treaties, including the rights of indigenous people, the right to water, the right to not have your land polluted. There are various international laws that this pipeline violates. And so there's an effort to say, to appear and appeal to international bodies to at least expose what's happened. And as I said, I think one of the most flagrant is the right of indigenous people to be consulted when there are projects that affect their land and their sacred sites and their water. And all over the world, indigenous people are raising these issues, but I think it's particularly stark here. And it's good that they've gone to the international body. And even previously, they had gone to the UN Rapporteur on the right to water and indigenous rights. So it is an international issue.
Jeff, you turned 74 last Sunday. You've been doing this kind of good work for a half century. I would hope that there'll be young lawyers that come out to North Dakota to get in on this. There are lawyers listening to this program, and we know there are. Who should they call? Who should they contact?
Well, I think it'd be good if they call the National Lawyers Guild, Mass Defense Office, King Downing, and told them, we've told King and the Mass Defense that we're looking for experience, that would be great for a young criminal lawyer to work with some of us who've been doing this on cases that I think are winnable. And you may get a free trip to North Dakota in December or January, and yeah, who could beat like, that? You know?
That's like second prizes 2 weeks in Philadelphia.
Yeah. But you've also got some, you know, a very exciting situation, and I think these cases allow, in some ways, to put the pipeline on trial. And so I think it would be a great experience for young lawyers to come up here, and that's exactly who we would like to attract. Young, experienced criminal defense lawyers.
Yeah, and I can only say that if people do go out there, they'll have a wonderful mentoring experience from you and other lawyers who have been there for a while.
Yeah, well, Bruce Ellison is here. He's been, as you all know, he's been active since Wounded Knee in 1973. He has an amazing, tremendous amount of respect with Native American people. He knows many of the people here. Yeah, working with him has been a real treat.
Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time to report once again on this developing situation, and we'd like to stay in touch over the next few weeks.
Well, thank you all, and I appreciate your covering this very important event and exciting encampment and stand against the pipeline.
Thanks,
thank
Jeff.
You.
Talk to you later.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Take it easy.
Thank you.
The general public becomes increasingly aware of the value of using open-source encrypted communications. Several groups of professionals may be among the first to regularly use it in their work. Members of the press already provide open-source whistleblower submission systems, such as SecureDrop, to protect the anonymity of sources. But how do attorneys protect their privileged client communications? Jonathan Striblingus founded Constitutional Communications to teach attorneys, activists, and others to use open-source encryption for all of their emails. The group is aptly named, given that, quote, "Our current system of internet communication is not constitutional, especially with respect to attorney-client communications," according to Striblingus, who is also a member of the National Lawyers Guild. His group has already provided intensive training sessions on digital security, domestically and internationally, to nearly 300 civil society leaders from dozens of countries. Joining us today is Jonathan Striblingus. Jonathan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, through our collective work over the years with the National Lawyers Guild, with Michael Ratner and the Center for Constitutional Rights, we here in the studio have long been aware that the government is likely monitoring our communications. Tell us a bit about how you came to form Constitutional Communications.
Thanks, yeah. Constitutional Communications came out of a lot of the work that I and a lot of other people had done, including the Center for Constitutional Rights, to really ensure that attorney-client privilege and communications between attorneys and clients were being respected by both the government as well as by possible adversaries. I actually started this project with organizers at the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU in order to really educate attorneys as well as civil society organizations about the need to use end-to-end open source encryption for privileged communication.
Now, what is open source encryption?
Sure. Free and open source software is really a social movement that has been built around computing for the last 20 years that involves ensuring that the computing programs can be viewed by technical experts so that you can make sure that they're doing what you think they're doing. It's a way to ensure that you have the most scientifically verifiable type of computing, and it actually creates the highest level of technological security and sophistication.
And how does that differ from so-called proprietary encryption?
So a lot of companies sell encryption systems, and unfortunately, as you can see in the Snowden documents, if you take time to look through them, there's a huge industry around ensuring that these proprietary tools are broken so that governments can get access to them. It's part of the planning process of security agencies. And so in order to make sure that the tools are not broken for someone else's benefit, you need to make sure that you can see how the tools actually function. And this is what open source software allows you to do.
Now, when you say broken, are you talking about what they call backdoor access?
Yeah. So when you're dealing with encryption is a way, usually a mathematical process, to scramble data so only the recipient can understand it. If you can create a situation where the scrambling has a way that an adversary already knows how to get into it, that's generally called a backdoor. And so that would be something where we've seen the U.S. government, actually some of the major standards that are used in encryption, including things used by BlackBerry, phone company, as well as a number of other, the NIST standard, the National Institutes of Science Technology standard, was actually backdoored by the NSA. This is one of the bigger Snowden revelations that folks should pay attention to when looking at the technical background of these tools.
So in other words, the NSA has influenced some of the sort of generally accepted protocols or standards for how we communicate.
Yeah, they've corrupted some of the technological standards. So RSA is one of the major manufacturers of encryption products, and the company, there's an algorithm and there's a company. The company was actually paid $10 million by the NSA to backdoor one of their standards.
Which is ironic because RSA, the three founders of that, were the original founders of encryption.
Yes, so they created a great encryption algorithm that is still functional, but the company that went on after their name was basically corrupted by the influence of the NSA and other corporate entities. And this is what you see consistently. Skype, for example, had been using encryption when it was a Swedish or Norwegian firm, and it actually was bought by Microsoft and then worked with the FBI in 2012 to backdoor their encryption. So it's an ongoing process that the security state engages in order to undermine the standards that we require. And that's why open source encryption is very important, to ensure we have standards that are scientifically verifiable.
As attorneys who value over anything else the confidentiality between their clients, why don't more attorneys encrypt? And what did you learn as you were forming this group?
Yeah, I think really the biggest issue around this is that the U.S. government has really colluded with industry and with corporations to kind of confuse the issue and ensure that these basic standards have been backdoored. And so only when you use open source encryption can you be sure that those things are actually effective. And so attorneys have not been given good information about this, because the people that are able to do advertising are corporations that are selling a product that's actually broken most of the time. And so I think what we need to do is ensure that clients are able to actually verify that their attorneys are using open source encryption. In a similar vein, clients have not been educated about this, and clients actually control attorney-client privilege, and so can demand attorneys use open source encryption for attorney-client communication, which is what we're advocating.
Jonathan, this is really appalling. It's like selling a Corvair that General Motors knew would explode.
That's a very good analogy.
So when you train attorneys in how to protect themselves and their clients, what does the training involve?
Some of it is kind of a more political and ethical training around what the professional requirements mean to us in terms of the need to respect attorney-client communication and the need to actually respond to clients' demands around this. And then a lot of it is actual technical training to understand the background of how these programs work. Some things are pretty easy to do, like download Signal, the Signal app. You can get it at app stores. I highly recommend it. It probably has the highest level of information security for a texting and calling app in terms of encryption. But also things like PGP are a little more complicated to use, and so it takes a little bit for attorneys to understand how to utilize those tools.
Now, the thing that I find interesting is you've described possibly a transformation in how people think of encryption as one of an ethical duty. Mm-hmm. So that the government constantly cries national security when they say that there shouldn't be encryption that they can't crack. Do you think professional organizations such as bar associations and those governing the ethics of attorneys statewide can view the need for encryption as one of ethics?
Yeah, I think already we're seeing this happen. Globally, we're seeing the UN come out with statements around the human rights necessity of encryption and anonymity in situations where we have multiple governments that are using mass surveillance as a default. And at the same time, we're seeing professional associations begin to take this more seriously. So even Massachusetts, the requirements for private businesses in Massachusetts to require encryption for personal data that attorneys as well as businesses are utilizing. And you can actually, there's out-of-state entities that have been fined by the Attorney General in Massachusetts for not encrypting the data that they were holding that was consumers' data. And so this is a consumer rights issue whereby consumers have been denied, as you're saying, actual working communications equipment that they need in order to communicate in the current era, right? In the same way that the car exploding would be a consumer rights issue, the communications being undermined by either corporations or government is something that consumers can take into their own hands and ensure that their attorneys, as well as other professionals they interact with, are required to utilize the best scientific open source end-to-end encryption for their communication.
Now, do you think, hypothetically speaking, that if I went to a law firm, I was an activist, for example, and I think a lot of what we're talking about is involves activist communication because they are often targeted by the government or by corporations. So say I'm an activist, I was involved in something, I went to a law firm, I told them I was concerned about privacy, and they did not engage in open source encryption. Could I possibly down the road have a lawsuit if those communications were monitored by the government?
I hope we could get there someday. I think in the current legal state, it's going to be difficult. I do think that there is a couple of claims currently for hacking, whereby attorneys there's a claim that is currently in court locally here that we've been dealing with that involves an attorney that was forwarded a bank address by a hacker that then they forwarded onto the client. So the client put their money in the wrong bank account because the attorney's system was undermined. And because the attorney wasn't using good information security, they didn't have basic things in place. And I think that in that case, it seems as though the client will win and in an action against the attorney. However, in the future, we hope to see that around encryption and secure communication as well, as this becomes more of a public interest need.
I've litigated in this area in terms of injuries to people. First, you have to show liability. You have to show that it happened, but then you have to show damages, what the actual harm was. So I think the instance that you just cited, where the person lost all their money because it was rerouted, you can show the harm. I think that it may be difficult, as the law stands now, to show any harm, even if you could show that it happened.
So this is actually one of the hardest things, is that people don't report hacking because it makes them look incompetent, as well as they don't see a way to actually deal with the issue. And so there's studies that have been done where they do surveys of information technology professionals who have self-reported that up to 67% of the systems that they deal with have been hacked. That's a huge number. These are people who work with corporations. This is not even just, you know, nonprofits or small organizations. So this is something that's really rampant. And we see this most clearly probably recently in the news with the DNC hack. And so the, you know, Democratic National Committee was hacked, and the emails were given to WikiLeaks, which allowed us to see the way that they were influencing the election between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. But the bigger question around that is, why was their information security so bad? If you look at how they were dealing with those emails, they had everything from their bank account numbers to people's social security numbers in an email account, which really is inappropriate in the current era. And actually, after that happened, if you believe Vanity Fair, they actually changed some of their systems to open source encryption as well.
Jonathan, how did you get involved in encrypting your communications?
Great question. Well, actually, as an activist, someone who had been doing a lot of organizing around these issues, about 10 years ago, I was actually asked by the Tibetan community in the U.S. And Students for a Free Tibet to assist them in doing an action in China during the Olympics in China in 2008. And so we raised Tibetan flags out in front of the opening ceremonies to the Olympics, which is illegal in China, and so we were deported. During that action, it was very clear to us that we needed to use encrypted communication. It was emphasized by the Tibetans as well as the Students for a Free Tibet that that China was monitoring all of their networks, and we had to use encrypted communication in order to effectively plan any type of activism in China. I didn't realize at the time that the U.S. government was doing much worse than what the Chinese government was doing, in the sense that the U.S. government actually actually goes and monitors networks around the world, not just within the U.S. But that was something that was emphasized to me in the action in China, was that we needed to encrypt our communication. And coming back to the U.S., I realized that activists here need to encrypt their communication as well. And we saw this mostly doing organizing with Iraq Veterans Against the War, whereby we were organizing with folks who were in the military or on bases and who were speaking out against the Iraq War. And we would be doing organizing and putting people's names into a Google Doc at the end of the day after we got people who wanted to speak out about military policy. And those people would end up fired from their positions, or they would not achieve what they were looking to achieve in the military. And we realized pretty quickly that Google and Google Docs were not appropriate for activist communication because of the way that Google was colluding with the U.S. government to give information to the bosses in the military, which was the people who we were trying to organize around.
It really stands democracy on its head. Jonathan, have you had a chance to see the Snowden movie?
I have. It's an excellent film, and I definitely think on the first thing I think is that Gordon Levitt really deserves an Oscar for his performance as Snowden. He was excellent, and especially given that Snowden is a living person, it's difficult to see him being such a good actor that he can actually mimic his characteristics. But it was really an excellent acting job, and then also I think it really is the first time I've seen a popular representation of the NSA's surveillance programs in a way that is understandable to everyday folks. And I think it's really important for people to see the film because it allows you to see kind of the intrusiveness of the programs that they currently operate and the way in which they don't have warrant requirements or any kind of basic constitutional needs around them. They don't have any constitutional legal requirements around them, and they are something that we need to drastically change. But the simplest way that we can get involved with that is learning about the technology that Snowden really has helped us understand better. And this is the part that is missing from the film, is that they don't go into the technical side, which is understandable given that it's a good, fun film to watch. So you don't want to spend too long on the technology. But I think that is something that Constitutional Communications is attempting to educate people around, is really the way that tech is something that Snowden has spent a lot of time trying to educate people around as well.
Well, how can people learn more about Constitutional Communications and your work?
For attorneys, we offer trainings with NICLA, which is the Bar Association here in New York City, where people or attorneys can go and get CLE credits to ensure that they know how to use open source encryption for their attorney-client communication. Again, open source encryption is also free, so it doesn't take any money for. So even small firms or small attorneys can use, single firms can do this. And also, you can go to our website, Constitutional Communications or concoms.org.
Repeat that, because people are hustling now to get a ballpoint pen. Repeat it.
The website for Constitutional Communications is constitutionalcommunications.org or concoms.org. There's a number of videos on our website that really deal with a lot of the issues that I've been discussing here, including a video of us talking with the UN Special Rapporteur, who's the kind of highest official around free expression in the world. And he's taken up the charge to really say that we need to require encryption for attorney-client communication. So you can see those videos and really educate yourself, and also educate your attorneys or accountants that they need to use open source end-to-end encryption for your communication.
Jonathan, you really deserve praise for coming up with such a creative and yet much needed project that will benefit not only attorneys and activists, but a lot of other professionals who need to be encrypting.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on today. And for folks who are interested in learning more, please go to the website constitutionalcommunications.org or concoms.org to learn more about how to both encrypt your own communication and influence your professionals, attorneys, accountants to use open source end-to-end encryption for their communications with you as well.
We'll do that.
Jonathan, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. Real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.